Welcome back to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. I'm Tony Trena. My guests this week are Mike Nouveau and Phil Toledano. Mike is a vintage dealer and the king of watch talk. He's got hundreds of thousands of followers across social media who tune in to his daily updates on life as a dealer in New York City. He in particular has become known for his love and expertise in vintage Cartier, which we'll certainly talk more about. Phil, of course, is no stranger to Hodinkee, having been on Talking Watches and this podcast previously. He's an artist and a photographer, a bon vivant, as well as a collector of all kinds of stuff, including watches. Most recently, he's the co-founder of Toledano & Chan, which just released its first watch, the Brutalist B1. He's also a frequent undercard on Mike's videos as Mr. Enthusiast. With that, let's bring in Mike and Phil. First of all, Phil Toledano, how are you doing today, sir?
As well as can be expected for a man of my advanced age.
Sure. Mike Nouveau, first time on the Hodinkee podcast. Welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
You know, Phil, as I mentioned, you were on the podcast back in 2018, if I recall. Look, a lot of people know your taste from Mike's videos or just from the wild, sometimes ugly things you post on your Instagram. But do you remember the sort of classy and elegant watch you were wearing that day?
On the Talking Watches?
No, not Talking Watches. We're going to get to that as well further back, but on the podcast back in 2018.
Oh, no. I mean, I can barely remember last week. I have no idea what I have for breakfast.
Oh, good. Well, I've got a nice surprise for you. It was the Cartier Tortue Monopusher from the CPCP from the 90s. You remember that watch?
Yeah, I do.
Was that a typical sort of catch and release for you that you owned for a few weeks and then got rid of?
No, I mean, it's not really a catch and release thing. It's just that there are so many watches that are interesting and there is a finite budget. So there are things that you buy, and every collector understands, there are things you buy and immediately sometimes you love it immediately, sometimes you hate it immediately, sometimes you love it, and then that love dissipates, like the mist in the early morning. So for that one, I actually kind of regret selling that one because I really thought that was beautiful.
Well, it's the year of the Tortue now. I wanted to get sort of Mike's thoughts, first of all. You know, people that know Mike know especially his love and interest in Cartier, vintage and modern, but Cartier. Mike, thoughts on the new Monopusher?
I think it's better than the CPCP version, actually. It's, you know, much less bulbous, which was probably the biggest complaint about the earlier version. Of course, the vintage versions are the best ones you can get, like, you know, but you're talking probably close to $1 million for the one that John Goldberger has, for example.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, it's a nice vintage tribute. I like it a lot.
Before we get too far into your individual histories and Toledano and Chan and stuff like that, I wanted to ask you, because this is actually a question I don't know the answer to, but how this sort of odd couple developed, like how did you guys meet and how did the relationship grow from there?
We have not known each other that long. I knew him from his Instagram page and I knew we had mutual friends. And I think the first time I ever met him was at an auction preview. And I introduced myself by saying I was friends with Scar, our mutual friend Scar. And he's like, oh, you know, and we kind of met. And then I think we had coffee a few days later and we filmed one watch spotting video for the TikTok, which did really well. And then he realized that he thrives off attention. So we kept going and we kept filming more stuff. And now we basically hang out together more than he hangs out with his wife.
Mike, since it's the first time we've talked to you at length on Hodinkee, I just want to get a little bit into your background and how you found watches. So I've known you a little bit now for a couple of years at least. But one of the things that struck me immediately is you seem like you have this kind of obsessive personality. I say this in the most positive way possible, if possible. But it seems like when you find something, you're all in. I know before watches, it was music and DJing and men's fashion. But can you just give us the quick rundown from there, how you found watches and then how you kind of went all in on watches and becoming a watch dealer and then like personality in the wider space even?
Sure. So I never had watches growing up, had no experience with watches whatsoever. I didn't know anything. And it wasn't even that long ago. I mean, less than 10 years ago, I bought my first vintage watch because I had been bought. I got a buyout for my rent stabilized East Village apartment in New York City. So for those who don't live in New York, basically, if you have a rent stabilized apartment, they can never, ever make you leave. And your rent is kind of under market price for many, you know, forever until you leave. And the only way to get you out is to offer you kind of a big check. And so I got one of those checks, not a life-changing one, but you know, a nice amount of money for, you know, a guy like in his 20s, I guess, at that point. And I did, someone through the men's fashion world was like, do you know anything about vintage watches? Do you know, like, I collect these vintage Rolexes, you should like look into this. And I started doing a little bit of research. I did like a year of research, basically, and I got really, really into it before buying anything. And I eventually bought a Rolex GMT Master Reference 1675, and that was my first watch. And I think by the time I bought it, I probably was like an expert in the reference. There was like not, there was no research left to do on the Reference 1675. So I bought the first one, and that was my only watch for many years. But I still, you know, did tons of research on other brands, other models. I was on the Rolex forums, vintage Rolex forums, Omega forums, et cetera, learning a lot. And just from, you know, talking to friends about it, you know, I kind of stumbled upon some kind of good deals on watches that maybe watches I didn't want for my personal collection or didn't have the money for, but I saw like a clear opportunity, like, okay, I can buy this right now for $5,000, but everyone else is selling it for $10,000. So, you know, I was like, okay, let me try it. What happens if I buy and sell one? And, you know, it works out and kind of gets bigger and bigger. And, you know, I did that for a bunch of years until kind of making kind of a leap into being like a full-time dealer.
And also, I've been playing and mentoring you, Michael. I mean, really, I think it's safe to say everything you know is from me. You sat at my knee on many an evening listening to my stories, horological stories.
Well, it is true. You do sell more watches than the average watch dealer, I'd say.
I think something I want to talk to both of you about a little bit. Mike, you said you started with Rolex at GMT, mm-hmm. 1675, mm-hmm. but from there it really evolved for you. You know, you post a lot about Cartier. Recently you've been speaking more about vintage Patek and the original mm-hmm. 96 Calatrava, stuff like that. Can you kind of just talk about the evolution from there of both your taste and just the types of watches you sort of specialize in?
Sure. I mean, I think like most collectors, maybe when they're first starting, Rolex probably seems like the peak. Obviously I love vintage Rolex, but after a while, you know, you kind of do get the urge to maybe expand a little bit. I mean, I look at like four digit Rolex, like traditional tattoos, like you can only get so many nautical stars and swallows tattooed on you before you're like, I wonder if there's more than these 10 designs in all of horology. And so, you know, I kind of expanded outwards from that. And, you know, I always appreciated the Cartier tank. And I also found it interesting that there was no real resource about Cartier. And it was still like really a mystery. I didn't even know where to begin, like which tanks out of 100 years of Cartier tanks were considered collectible, which weren't. How come I see some on eBay for $800? And how come I see similar ones for $12,000 or $50,000? So I kind of fell into a rabbit hole again of Cartier, and I'm like, okay, vintage, you know, 1970s, late 1970s, this is probably a good place to start. I would say, you know, all three houses of Cartier were recombined, and, you know, production was moved to Switzerland for, you know, uniformity, and that's kind of where you start seeing more production numbers. And I thought, you know, this is a good, and I still think that's the best spot to start. And I bought my first one, which was a Tank Louis Jumbo Automatic, because I saw people pricing this watch similarly to a regular Tank Louis. This is the more or less the only automatic tank ever made, including today. So I'm like, wow, this is a very unique little thing. Out of 100 years of Cartier tanks, this one for 3 years was made with an automatic movement. And even today, they still only produce quartz or mechanical movements. So I'm like, wow, this is a really interesting little thing. So let me find a nice one. I bought it for probably similar price to what the regular hand wind ones were selling for. And then I realized, wow, people don't know how to price these, because this is so much more rare and as a collector more desirable than one that's being sold for the same price right next to it, probably because the seller is not like fully educated on the differences of these. So I started kind of buying them up, and I still have the, you know, the first one I bought, the first, you know, I didn't sell one until I owned maybe three. And then I'm like, I'm just going to keep buying these guys. I think these are so, the 70s tanks are so undervalued. I mean, it's the Submariner. It's the Calatrava. I mean, it's such an iconic piece of design, and they're still available, you know, for what I think is a very fair price for like the most iconic gold dress watch. So I still continue to buy them like to this day.
You still feel like today, even some of these 70s standard size Tank Louis, and then obviously the automatics, you still feel like they are a little undervalued as to like what they are historically and the importance and all that?
I think the tank, the automatic version has reached kind of where it should be. It's over $20,000. Gotcha. I think when I bought mine, it was seven or six. The Tank Louie, the regular 70s Tank Louie hand wound, you know, you could find them between 7 and 12,000, somewhere around there. And every time I see a nice one, I buy it. If someone has 10 of them, I'll buy 10 of them. I really think they're amazing.
Bill, I spotted a rectangular and or square watch on your wrist. I have to imagine it's not a Cartier Tank. I have to imagine that's way too boring for you. But can you give us a peek at what you've got on today?
Sure. It's a Patek. I forgot what the reference number is, from 1962 with sapphire markers.
Got it. So it's like a square.
We'll have to take your word for it with your video quality.
Yeah, right. I'll send you a sketch. I'll fax you a sketch.
Yeah. So anything else you know about this watch? Square, rectangular, beautiful little Patek. I mean, this is kind of in your wheelhouse, huh? Maybe even a little bit earlier than some of the more audacious Patek designs that you go for, huh?
It's interesting because for me, Patek kind of straddles, at least in the 60s and 70s, they straddled two worlds. One was really audacious and the other was extraordinarily formal. And the audacious stuff, the courageous stuff, I find really, really interesting and beautiful. And for the money, I feel like it's unbeatable. I mean, you know, this particular reference with these markers is incredibly rare, but it doesn't cost a large amount of money, which is always the Venn diagram of joy for any watch nerd.
Kind of speaking of that, actually, the other day, Mike, you posted a video with one Mr. Enthusiast, our own Mr. Mm-hmm. Enthusiast. And I was surprised about the watch that you bought, Phil, at the New York auctions just here a few weeks ago. So can you give us a little bit of talk a little bit more about what that watch was and why it was even appealing to a guy like you?
Well, a guy like me has very broad tastes, and there are a lot of things that interest me. I'm not just interested in crazy stuff. I've always, for the last, I'd say, 6 or 7 years, I've been really obsessed with Rolex pre-Daytonas, in particular the early stuff in the 40s. So the Rolex Xerograph, for those nerds who are unaware, is basically the first Rolex Oyster chronograph they ever made, the first with a in-house movement, the first with the rotating bezel. So it's all these first. They've only been 5 or 6 examples known to be people aware of. And it was always a dream, and it was always, as far as I'm concerned, an unattainable dream, because it just, you know, when you see them at auction, they're 300 grand, 400 grand. I mean, you know, that as far as I was concerned, it was never going to happen. One came up at Sotheby's, and Mike was there, and I was talking to Mike and Adam Golden, and I was like, okay, what do you guys think? And I mean, you know, the people thought it's going to go in the low to mid hundreds, and sometimes at auction, every now and then, there's kind of a black hole manifests itself, and things just slip through the net for whatever reason. People aren't paying attention. It's the wrong time of day. People have gone for lunch, whatever. I mean, like that Cartier Monopoussoir you commented on earlier, I was the only bidder at auction for that watch. No one else bid on that watch when I won that. So things, and I've been successful, like just putting in a bid, and sometimes just things, miracles happen. So the Rolex Xerograph happened. I couldn't believe it happened. Actually, the lot was passed, and then I called them up and I was like, I'd like to, you know, see if we can make it work. And they reopened the lot. I put in a bid, and again, no one was interested. So I won the watch.
It's wild, because I did just a little auction preview the week before, the week leading up to the auction, and that was one of the ones I mentioned as like, look out for this lot. I know the estimate was 50 to 100,000, and the last one that I remember selling was, to your point, like almost $200,000 at Monaco Legends. But this one obviously was not that.
It was 266 euro. But look, again, I mean, these are not watches that are, it's a very particular, odd kind of watch. Not a lot of people, I imagine, would be very interested in it. It's 32 mil. But to me, of course, it's history, but it's also just this beautiful, strange, unusual thing. And I just like beautiful, strange things.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I think I said this as well about this watch and then another watch I'm going to get to in a second. But 32 millimeters, an old watch from the 30s, it's not the kind of thing that a lot of people are super interested in. So you get the two right people bidding and it could go for $200,000, $300,000. But if you get one wrong person in your case bidding, it might just go for, you know, $50,000 or whatever it is after they have to reopen it. So it is what it is. But congrats on a cool historical sort of Xerograph. But Mike, the other watch I mentioned there that I was going to talk a little bit more about is one that you've been sort of talking about more lately on your various platforms, the Calatrava, specifically the 96. I know you bought one personally for yourself and you've been sort of buying them up, but if you could just talk about the appeal of those watches first of all, and then what you've been doing with them.
Yeah, I mean, another one I'm kind of head over heels on the first Patek Calatrava ever, starting in the 1930s, reference 1996. It's only 30.5 millimeters. I'm wearing mine right now. It actually wears so well to when I try on the larger version, which came a little bit later, the reference 570, which is only 35.5 millimeters. It seems humongous. It seems almost too big. So yeah, they made this Calatrava for 40 years from the 30s to the 70s. There's a million different dial variations, which is something I like as well. Kind of like the day-date, where you can collect day-dates for 30 years and you'll still find stuff, combinations you haven't seen before. I don't know why they just speak to me. I think they were underappreciated for a long time. I know the Japanese were buying them up. A lot of dealers tell me, oh, I was sending these to Japan for the last 10 years or whatever. I just think it's a very, very cool, important historical Patek. I think the size is right. I think like most people wear watches that are too big for them. I think this is like the perfect size. When you hear 30.5, you're like, wow, that is very small. But I mean, I think it wears amazingly. And yeah, I mean, a lot of people are looking for them. Not, you know, way before I started talking to them, people were certainly looking for them. I just think now prices are going up. We saw one at Antiquorum, a regular steel stick dial. Like, steel is rare, but in terms of configuration, it's a very common configuration. I think it went for like $45,000 or something. I mean, for a regular steel stick dial. So yeah, I mean, people are obviously paying attention to them. I'm looking for them. Hard to find nice ones. That's the other thing about them. And they're difficult to find ones that have not been over polished or messed with in some way. But yeah, I mean, I love 40s Patek and I love the 96.
Can you talk a little bit more about, so you just, you know, for people on the audio that aren't watching on YouTube, which is most people, mm-hmm. you're wearing a nice steel Patek Calatrava with a, is it a GF bracelet on it as well?
Yeah, it's a 1940s Gaffer bracelet. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Brigade numerals as well, mm-hmm. right? Is it a long mm-hmm. signature, sort of it's a long signature one as well? Yeah. Nice. So
1941.
So obviously one of the more desirable variants, if you will, I would say, mm-hmm. of 96s. But can you talk about, you mentioned like trying to find good ones and what that means, but can you just talk a little bit more like what differentiates for you as a dealer and a collector, even just like one you would want to go in on buying versus a crappy one or one that you would pass on?
Sure. I mean, the easiest way to tell, like with Rolex, is the lugs and the lug holes. It kind of gives it away a bit. If it's something, if it has toothpick lugs, it's means it's probably been over polished. Probably a pass. I mean, there's some leeway. I mean, we're talking about watches that are, you know, 80 years old. The dial is obviously extremely important. Same with Rolex. You know, the way these dials were built, they were built to be restored. They were built to be cleaned. You don't want it to be over restored or over cleaned or reprinted or something like that. So you have to look at the enamel. You have to look at the zircon. You have to really examine these dials. Cleaning is okay. Washing is okay. You know, it's kind of a thin line between restoration and forging. But you know, it really takes, you really, really have to study these things. I'm not, you know, I'm still learning more about this era of Patek and how these dials were made kind of every day. And you really need to kind of assess each one individually. Sometimes, you know, if you sent a watch back to Patek for service, they were probably going to clean the dial or refinish the dial. And sometimes it involved removing the markers. Sometimes it's really more of just like an actual cleaning, like you think of cleaning. Sometimes it's more of a sanding to the dial. And sometimes you can see the vertical stripes from a restoration service. But yeah, you kind of really have to assess each one. At the end of the day, it still has to look good. It has to look good. You know, nobody wants a crappy dial on their watch. So some people, even if they know it's been restored, they prefer that over, you know, one with crazy patina or, you know, water damage or rust or whatever.
Yeah, it's funny you kind of got into the dial cleaning and condition and all that type of stuff. I did an article that'll, I think, will be published by the time this has run, actually, just about sort of dial condition. And mm-hmm. I was talking about the 1463 in particular, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. we were just talking about this the other day a little bit, Mike, but the really nice one that sold at Antiquorum Geneva last month.
Eberhard signed.
Yeah, really beautiful watch. One of the best ones I've sort of seen this year. But comparing that to some of the other recent ones that have come up, and just like the condition of a vintage Patek can 2x or 3x the cost, like just absolutely entirely based on condition.
And I think the one at Antiquorum sold low, actually.
Yeah. We talked about the same watch a few weeks ago, and Eric Koo and Justin Grunberg said kind of the exact same thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, Mike and Phil, I think you guys have quite defined tastes, and obviously you're posting a lot on Instagram, so people kind of understand your taste, but they don't overlap a ton. I think, Mike, you kind of had this classic taste in a way, and Phil, yours is, I don't know how to describe yours. I don't know if we even can in a few words, but I'm wondering where you guys overlap in sort of the taste you have in watches and where you disagree.
is there any overlap? I'm trying to think if there's any.
No, I like the 96s a lot.
Yeah.
And I think it's safe to say you've ventured into the 70s Patek a little bit here and there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, and look, as for Cartier, I mean, I'm not a huge tank person, but I really admire the audacity of Cartier and their design in terms of shape over the last 100 years. They've really been on the forefront of being courageous with shape. And that's so interesting to me. You're not really into the pre-Daytona stuff, are you, though?
No. I'm not really into Daytonas at all.
Yeah, but Daytona and pre-Daytona is a totally different creature.
Can you unpack that?
Let's say I'm not that into, I've never really cared about Rolex chronographs. Let's say that. Not for any particular reason. I just never, they just never did much for me personally, even though I know obviously it's an iconic thing, blah, blah, blah. Paul Newman. I don't know how much more I could hear about it, but yeah.
Bill, can you talk a little bit more about the appeal for these pre-Daytonas for you? It's kind of, compared to a lot of the other stuff you collect and talk about, it seems kind of out of left field or relatively conservative, I could be so bold as to say. So what's the appeal there?
Well, I mean, those are the ones I've had in my collection the longest. The 70s Patek stuff is the last 4 or 5 years, as for the same for the Midas stuff. I don't know. I had a big Eberhardt collection for a while, Prix Extra Fort from the 40s. I really, really, really love the 1940s design aesthetic with that kind of tachometer and all that stuff on the inside of the dial. And the Rolex pre-Daytona, I really love because there's this peculiar paradoxical design aesthetic happening where you have this kind of 1940s aesthetic sandwiched into a Rolex Oyster case, which we're really familiar with. So you have this kind of juxtaposition of 1940s and then this kind of eternal 19 Rolex steel case thing happening. And I like that. I like that kind of design surprise. And I've always loved them. I just think they're incredibly interesting, really rare, really beautiful. And you know, ironically, so much more interesting and so much rarer than a Rolex Daytona, which are endless amounts. I guess, look, the snob in me likes the fact there aren't many around, and I like the kind of, I like obscure things. I like that. That's appealing to me.
Yeah, the snob in you is most of you. I mean, to be fair, right?
Let's be honest. It's as Mike will happily attest to.
There's some snobbery in all of us. It's, you know, it's about wanting what not everybody else has. That's kind of how collecting works.
It's true. And I mean, it's interesting how it manifests itself. Like if you like Rolex Daytonas, then you will be like, this is a four liner, this is an underline or whatever it is. Like this, there are so many fascinating ways in which we delineate our snobbery when it comes to collecting.
Bill, I wanted to just talk a little bit more about the way in which your taste, if you can even call it that, has evolved over the years, because I was looking at your Talking Watches, which was back in 2016, obviously link it in the show notes, but about half of the watches you showed were vintage Breitlings, which is, I was surprised to sort of remember that. Some of the other things were these more audacious 70s designs, which you've really gone to in the past few years, but can you just talk a little bit more about what the hell has happened with Phil Toledano's collection in the past few years and how it's evolved?
I was a huge vintage Breitling collector. I actually think that of all the 60s watches, they have the most interesting design, like versus like Hoyer or well, for sure. I mean, of the sort of second tier, I guess, watch brands, I found them really interesting, really beautiful. The 765 AVI with that little jump out 15 minute counter thing. Yeah. The Super Oceans are incredible. I loved all those things. And then at some point I was like, no, I'm going to sell all those and get into pre-Daytona, which is what I did. And then I had like a small military watch collection. Then I got really into the 70s stuff. Then I got massively into like Rolex King Midas, the Pateks from the 70s. But there's so many interesting corners to root around in. It just seems churlish almost not to explore.
Churlish.
Oh, yeah. I knew you'd enjoy that.
Pull out the dictionaries to all the listeners for that one. Jeez.
It does. It seems churlish to not to like, there are so, it's like, look, there are so many dishes if you want to use a food analogy, to taste, to sample, why wouldn't you just try them all? I mean, they're, you know, like, why stick with the old Tony Trainer Rolex Explorer?
Low blow.
We're putting you on a 10-second mute anyway, Phil, for that low blow. While you're in the penalty box, Mike, you mentioned something earlier about sort of 1970s when all of the Cartier houses combined and mm-hmm. sort of became one, and they started building out their Swiss manufacturing. But you also talk a lot about the differences in 1960s and pre-1970s mm-hmm. Cartier when they were making things in Paris, and then I suppose separately mm-hmm. in London as well. But mm-hmm. maybe you could talk a little bit more about the appeal of these Paris watches, for example, and how you've handled enough of them even. So just how they feel different to you in hand and when you're wearing them and stuff like that.
Sure. I mean, these watches really feel kind of handmade. Once you go, I mean, people may or may not know, before whatever it is, 1972, the numbers of watches Cartier was producing per year were, the numbers were so, so small. I mean, there was years where 100 watches were made. There were years where 20 watches were made, like in the 1920s and 30s. There's, you know, we have the archives, which kind of show you how many movements were ordered or how many cases were made. And these numbers are so, so small. These watches are so rare. I mean, people probably see the 70s stuff fairly regularly, and obviously the newer stuff, the 80s stuff is very common. But once you go before 1972, it gets so, so uncommon and so hard to find. And these, when you handle them, you really like, wow, these really were made in some little atelier somewhere with no aspects of mass production. These were little pieces of jewelry that they were able to fit a watch movement into. It's highly, highly fascinating. It goes back to the same thing I was saying about the day-dates and the 96s, where everyone you see can be different. There's always, always new stuff to discover. You can find something that you've never seen before. It's not in any book. And now you have to say, like, is this real? Is this, was this made once in 1942 by special order, or is this a complete fabrication? So it's like another step, because you're not going to walk into a jewelry store and find a Rolex never before seen, no documentation of. It's not going to happen. With Cartier, it happens all the time, because these things were made in such small quantities from three different houses, New York, London, and Paris. And, you know, who knows what, you know, there might be a movement number and a case number written down, but you might not know what that watch was, how it left the atelier and who it went to. And or it could be a completely new design that no one has ever seen before.
I have this keen memory of back when we went to the Miami Beach Antique Show. All of us were there, actually. Phil, what did you buy at the Miami Beach Antique Show?
I bought the Chopin Samaritz skeleton.
That thing's long gone, right?
Yeah, and then I bought a Piaget, white gold Piaget polo.
Ah, okay. And do you still have the polo?
I do.
Wow. This is going to be the longest time you've ever held a watch for. What's that, almost 4 months now?
I don't know why you guys give me so much abuse about this. Don't be churlish, Mike.
I'm trying not to be churlish, but the churlishity is blowing out of me.
Yeah, you took the low blow at me, Phil, so I'm just trying to return it, my friend. But Mike, one of the watches that you found there that I sort of keenly remember was, it turned out to be a Cartier tank made for New York. Mm-hmm. And I had seen the watch in the case, actually. And I just like probably glazed past it as something that looked like maybe even a must tank, you know, these mm-hmm. sort of cheap watches that they made with quartz movements later mm-hmm. on. But you had sort of a keen eye and found it, made a video about it, obviously, later on, and even bought the watch. But mm-hmm. can you just talk about finding watches like that, and then even in particular these Cartier New York watches that are like kind of hard to find and rare?
Cartier New York in the 1970s were, you know, ordering watches just for Cartier New York that London and Paris potentially knew very little about, and they had slightly different fonts, different design, like very, very slightly. You know, the chemin de fer was a little bit more wide, the numerals were maybe a little bit more wide, and they had completely different movements than what you would have gotten in Paris. And, you know, they're valuable and people collect them. If you're one of the whatever 50 or 100 people who care about this, then it's collectible. But if you're just a jeweler somewhere, you don't know the difference. So I saw it. I said, how much is that? In my head, I was thinking, please say under $15,000. And he said, it's $7,000, the same price as all of them. I said, can I see it? And I looked at it. And I said, what kind of movement's in here? Do you know what the movement is? He goes, yeah, it's a manual movement. I said, oh, okay, a manual movement. Thank you for being specific. And obviously I bought it and it sold very quickly because once you kind of, even if someone doesn't know about it, when you teach someone about it, it's a pretty interesting thing. I mean, this, you know, famous French jewelry house, they had a New York branch, which obviously is still here, and they made stuff for New York clientele. And this is like a tank that looks 4% different than every other tank, but it's just like a little piece of Cartier history that I find quite collectible. And I really, really like them.
Inside, the movements are different and they were using different suppliers than mm-hmm. Cartier Paris.
Yes. You know, let's see, whatever that. Yeah, this was early 1970s. So probably during, there was like a crossover period of a few years where, you know, the houses were officially rejoined, but production was still all over the place. So probably from like 70 to 78 or something like that, stuff still came out. You can kind of tell by the different hallmarks that was still New York, Paris, that were different than what came just, you know, a year or two later. So yeah, some of them have Audemars Piguet movements, some of them have Etta movements, some of them are Jaeger signed Cartier. So yeah, you had a whole kind of, you never know until you open it up to see.
Bill, I want to go back to you for a little bit because you obviously took the watch world by storm just here in the past month or so with the release of, well, the announcement first, I suppose, of Toledano and Chan, your new brand, and then your first watch, which was called the B1. How are we calling it?
B1 is good.
All right. So the sort of brutalist take. I think a lot of people know the story by now and the inspiration from architecture in New York and that specific build. What was the specific building called, Phil?
It's the Whitney, the Marcel Breuer Whitney Museum. Gotcha. In Midtown.
I'm not a New Yorker, so I defer to you on this. But okay, so a lot of people know the story by now, know the watch. It sort of quickly sold out through a variety of channels, through the Hodinkee shop, a few sold via Mike, and then you obviously sold on your own website as well. But it sold out in, what, 45 minutes or something?
Pretty much.
So we extend our congrats to you for that. But as I said, people kind of know the story and the origin story of the B1, but I want to sort of get your take a little bit more on what you view as the vision of the brand and kind of what statement you're trying to make and how you did that with the B1.
I guess for me, for Alfred and I, the brand is really, it's about sculpture and it's about materials. Those are the two most important things. And so I think going forward, we're going to pursue those two angles, those two lines. Like we're so interested in exploring new materials. I mean, we auctioned a pièce unique at Sotheby's that was the first watch made out of carbon fiber infused with copper. So we want to continue to be interesting and surprising. And in some ways, if you look to, say, Genta in the 90s, he was so experimental in the kinds of collisions of different materials he used. And that's really exciting. It's really exciting to see that. So we'd like to kind of reinvigorate that spirit. And do things that are incredibly audacious from a shape perspective, but also from a materials perspective. That was a good corporate blather for you, wasn't it?
It was. So let's break it down and tell us what that really means going forward. I mean, you did the B1. Do you have plans for a new release? Can you talk a little bit about what that's going to look like? Is it going to be a take on the B1? Are you going to do something completely different? New materials, new shapes? What are we looking at here?
I think we're going to stick with the same shape. What are we looking at, kid? I feel like you're just going to serve me a pound of meat at the butchers. What do you need?
I know, that sounded kind of mean. I'm sorry.
No, it didn't sound mean, man. It was just hard-hitting investigative journalism, man. That's what that was.
Thanks. Someone finally recognizes it. Thanks, Phil.
I think we're going to stick with the same shape for the near future, but what we're looking at is materials, and as I said, different collisions of different materials and treatments and all that kind of stuff. I mean, as an artist, the most exciting part is always the idea part. The least exciting part is the idea when the collision between the idea and reality. But yeah, that's what we're kind of looking at now. It's just how to make something that's equally surprising. There's four or five ideas on the table right now.
The Hodinkee exclusive travel clock in the works too, right?
There's one with sand in it that just is like an hourglass version of the B1 on your wrist, though. That's going to be the radical innovation.
I think that this is the most sort of conservative is kind of a scary thought. But you mentioned something there that I want you to talk a little bit more about, is just kind of ideas colliding with the reality. And I suppose that means the reality of actually manufacturing these crazy things that that pop out of your brain. What was the hardest part of manufacturing the B1, or the thing that you sort of ran into that was really difficult for you guys?
Well, I'll tell you a funny anecdote. Usually when you order from a factory, any factory, there's have a MOQ, a minimum order quantity.
Yeah.
And for us, the MOQ was 300. But then the factory said to us, look, this is such a pain in the ass to make. We will happily make way less for you. So it happened because I guess the thing about the watch is it's extraordinarily difficult to make because there are so many surfaces, so many beveling, so many finishes. There's two or three different kinds of finishing happening on the watch. So it's just incredibly complicated. So it took us a long time. And with a watch like the B1, okay, I'm going to say something and then Mike will step in with the shiv and just give me a quick jab to the ribs, preparing yourself. It's like a beautiful sentence. There is no place for misplaced punctuation. Cue Mike.
It's beautiful. You're bringing a tear to my eye. I have no comment to
come
add.
Come on, man. Surely you've got
I feel moved.
But it really is like the thing about that design is that it's very hard. You can't, if you make a mistake with finishing or manufacturing, you can't hide it on that watch. So that was the trickiest part, is getting it to a point that was satisfactory to both Alfred and I, just from an aesthetic standpoint, a finishing standpoint. And even now, we look at it and we're like, oh, there's so many things we can make better.
You want to give any examples of what you could do better? Or is that just going to make your clients that bought it just really angry?
You know what? You might be right. I will not say, look, with anything you make, the first one is always a revelation. Like you make something and you think it's perfect. And then when it contacts the outside world, you realize it wasn't as perfect you thought, and there's things you can make better. So we're always going to try and make it better. But you know, it's been an extraordinary experience, man, to be honest.
So your partner, Alfred, you mentioned is based out in Hong Kong, right?
So just so you know, Mike is convinced he's an AI figment of my imagination.
No one's ever seen this guy.
Well, he's in Hong Kong. We've never actually met, but Mike is convinced that he's an AI recreation,
split personality type of thing. Well, let's assume he's real for just a second, or stipulate that he's real. I wanted to ask, sort of, obviously, I guess he's in that part of the world, which makes it easier to work with your suppliers that are over there. But anything you learned about manufacturing in Hong Kong and China and all of that, that you were just surprised by, perhaps?
Well, I think, look, that we talked a lot about where to make the watch, and Alfred lives in Hong Kong, so naturally he's a watch designer, so he has all these connections in mainland China and Hong Kong to make stuff for us. But we did talk a lot about it, but the price point was an issue, and we didn't want it to be a really expensive watch. I will say the one thing that was kind of gloriously surprising is the speed at which we could try things. And so we tried a bunch of stuff. And it was pretty quick to get like a rough prototype of, okay, is this a good idea? Is this not a good idea? And that was, but again, I have nothing to compare it to. So, but I feel like if we did it in Switzerland, we'd still be in production.
Yeah. Well, if they even wanted to work with a nut like you, you know,
I'm a very appealing nut, man. Salty, but sweet.
Sure. Honey roasted, huh?
You're doing it for me. I have nothing to add.
You've gotten to the point now where you just roast yourself. It's too easy almost. Well, it kind of gets to the last thing I want to talk about. I can't believe we've gotten sort of 45 minutes in or whatever it's been without even talking about the TikTok of it all, I suppose, or the social media of it all. But obviously you guys are sort of very niche celebrities in that part of the world. But we got to start with Mike here, obviously, and talk about how that even started for you. Obviously, a lot of people know you as Mike Nouveau on TikTok, and you started it a few years ago. I mean, really just with watch spottings, with mm-hmm. friends and people you spotted on the streets in New York. And it's really evolved from there to change your life, I imagine. But can you just talk about how that even came about and how it's evolved to where it is now?
I was a watch dealer before, but really nobody knew me. I have a lot of friends that were in like kind of the men's fashion space that made TikToks, and they saw their lives kind of change a little bit with the success of their TikToks, and they're like, you should really get on here because there's no watch content on here and you can, you know, maybe, you know, get some followers. So I made one video a watch finding video asking someone in the street about their watch. And the very first video got a couple of 100,000 views, which is even today I would consider very, very successful for a video. And then I did it every single day. And then after just a couple, people were asking me questions about watches. I didn't put my face on it. My name was on the account, but nobody knew who I was. And then I never thought I was going to get in front of the camera. And then very quickly, people were asking me questions about watches, how to source, how to authenticate, why vintage, et cetera. So I started talking to the camera, and those, you know, videos did decently enough. And then it expanded to all watch content on, you know, these little short 1 minute videos I do every single day. And it kind of took off from there. And that's kind of like how I started it. And yes, it definitely changed my life a lot for sure. It brings me amazing watches, which is the best part. Like, people come to me with amazing watches to buy or sell, which really, really is the best part. And I've experienced some of that with Cartier, with Breguet, with Patek, or just, you know, an entire younger generation who don't know any other dealers. They DM me with amazing watches, and maybe I could buy them or help them sell them. So it's really kind of that's the best part, because in this entire business, the entire hobby, the hardest part is finding the watches. That's what I always tell people, that's the hardest part. So if you have people coming to you with incredible watches, I mean, it's you can't even put a value on that. So yeah, it's definitely benefited me as a collector and a dealer. And you know, and I now have kind of a podium from which to speak my opinions about the watch world,
to berate people.
Just more, just you
in particular. Yes. Yeah. You know, you mentioned something there for a while. You didn't even sort of come out in front of the camera, but you've done that since then. And I think one of the things
I came out as a TikToker.
One of the things that you do really well, if I may say, number one, I think you're like super authentic, which people connect with. Is the whole
Tony,
New York?
We have to do this, Tony. Please don't give him any compliments, man.
I know.
Disconnect this geezer.
This is super painful, but look, this is the complimentary portion of the show, Phil. None are coming your way, but Mike's way for sure. Look, you managed to be super authentic. There's the New York scene and all of that I think people are connected to, but you managed to toe the line between being informative and just like pure entertainment every day. Can you talk about, did you strike that balance initially? And then even just kind of putting yourself in front of the camera, what that felt like to you, and sort of, was it difficult to do that?
It was difficult to get in front of the camera. I am very sensitive to cringe. And I'm realizing that as like at that point in my late 30s, getting in front of the camera for this app that, you know, the perception is that it's for kids. In reality, I found out that it's definitely not. There are serious buyers, sellers of watches on this app. My demographics are not even, I think my highest segment is like 26 to 34 or something like that. So it's not super young. It really would be very, very foolish to ignore this segment. And now you see dealers and people making content, the same people who were laughing earlier, Adam Golden, are now making content of their own. So yeah, it was hard to get in front of the camera. And I think I've never been afraid to share my opinions. I am obsessive. It's truly like who I am. So I love talking about these things. And if people want to buy a Cartier tank because I am obsessed with Cartier tanks, then that's great. But you know, I'm not lying to people. I'm not faking the enthusiasm. It's really, really, it's real. I really get excited by these watches. Finding a new watch is incredible to me. Being able to, make money off like an insane obsession is also, like, no matter what, I have friends, who, you know, have more money that I can dream of, who still get the excitement of finding a watch for $5,000 and selling it for $6,000. So yeah, I mean, it's amazing being able to do this. And I don't know why people like the videos, but I guess they do.
Bill, I don't think you ever had any trouble sort of getting in front of the camera on Mike's channel or otherwise, but what's it been like for you sort of going along for the ride, sort of off and on as Mr. Enthusiast and being in Mike's videos every once in a while?
Let me tell you, it was always my dream to reach middle age and play an ancillary character on Mike Nouveau's universe.
Middle age? We're not talking about 25 years ago.
I mean, look, it's pretty entertaining. I mean, people recognize me. You're that guy in that guy's video is usually how I'm recognized, which is really what I was hoping for.
after 30 years as an artist, God knows how many published books,
That's right.
This is how you'll be remembered.
That's right.
As the guy in the jumpsuits in my videos.
Yeah.
Mike, I think one of the other things you do relatively well is you...
Keep them coming. Keep them coming.
When I hang out with you, you seem to divide the line between, okay, I'm getting content versus I'm just hanging out and being an actual human. How do you even manage to do that and not view the entire... Maybe you do view the world this way, as everything is potential content to be harvested, but you seem to divide it relatively well. How you manage that?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's good. It's good to be documenting stuff in general, even if I wasn't posting it. If I see a moment that I think other people would enjoy, and like you said earlier, there is a big New York aspect to this. I think New York is almost like a character in the videos. People all the time comment, is this really what happens in New York? Is New York really like this? I just, you know, if I see something interesting, I take out the phone and I start recording if it's appropriate to do so.
If I can say something actually about Mike, if I have to, I'll be introducing him later. But the reason why it works is because New York is very much like Mike. Like, it's quite, New York is unalloyed, and it's brusque, and it can be rude, and it can be funny, and it can be interesting. And those are all things, sadly, that Mike embodies.
Thank you.
Oh, the beautiful backhanded compliment. Mike, obviously, you guys did some videos about the Toledano and Cheyenne and the B1. But Mike, what were your thoughts when you first saw it and Phil was presenting prototypes to you?
No, I mean, I thought it was cool. I thought it was amazing. I'm very proud of him. It's very cool. It's truly not like anything else. If you want a cool designy watch, like a 70s inspired, I don't know what you buy today. I mean, I guess in the last few weeks, a few more have come out. But really, if you wanted a geezer watch and you only had a 4-digit budget, I mean, this was the one to buy. I think it's very cool. I really like them, obviously. I wouldn't promote them. I think Phil knows I wouldn't promote it if I didn't like it.
Yeah.
You would know on certain terms.
Yeah. I think it's really amazing. I think what's happened with it is very cool. The fact that it's sold out super quick, the fact that they're on Chrono 24 right now for double the price is like mind-boggling. I'm really glad that I have an extra 10 under my bed that I ordered directly from Hong Kong. No, I'm just kidding. I wish I had some extras, because I mean it's like the Monterey 2 at this point.
Yeah, it's your 401k right there.
You should have called it the Monterey 3.
Sure, I'm sure Arnaud would have been delighted.
Phil, Mike just alluded to it, but there's kind of been this boom in design-driven watches. I feel like it's a lot of smaller brands or new brands like yours. We've covered things like Anoma and Amida on the site as well, but even AP did the remaster too, coincidentally, just a couple of weeks after yours. So I'm wondering, speak individually about the AP or any of those other watches I mentioned, but just in general, this boom in sort of more design-driven watches we've seen over the past few years.
Beautiful timing on that AP release.
It was right after yours, right, Phil?
Yeah, it couldn't have been better. I mean, yeah. The funny thing was, people were messaging me going, I can't believe AP stole your design, as if like this giant Swiss, you know, Gulliverian size company would in 2 weeks just whip out a watch.
I mean,
reacting to the behemoth Toledano and Chan.
It is fun. It's funny you say that, because obviously I'm sure they've been working on this watch for 5 years.
Yeah.
But just that 2 weeks, really, I mean, people really were saying, like, oh, what's going on here? Just because of Toledano and Chan now, all these. I mean, if you had launched 2 weeks later, and of course, again, obviously AP was not inspired by this watch, but the optics of it are so amusing to me, because it really is something like fairly similar, and it does look like, you know, for some just on the outside, it almost does look like AP is chasing Toledano and Chan a little bit, and it's like very, very amusing to me.
I mean, you're right, and it was crazy to even be in the conversation with AP. I mean, we're nothing, we're just a couple of geezers. And we're suddenly, you know, people are comparing our watches. I mean, it was just lunacy. But in response to your question, man, I would say, and I think I'm sure that I feel like Mike, you probably feel the same way, but I am so delighted just to see the landscape open up beyond, like, you know, steel sports Rolexes and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's so great just to see more imagination in how people collect.
Yeah. One of the things I want to wrap up with both of you is kind of just what's next, I suppose. This could be the plug whatever you're up to portion of today's programming, if you want to get self-promotional about it. But just what's next for both of you as far as the business projects you're working on, or just if you want to talk about your personal collecting, anything like that. Mike, we can start with you.
Okay, so I have an app that just came out. It's called Pushers. It's in the App Store. It's basically a platform to browse through watches, and we connect you directly to the dealer. There's no middleman. It's just a cool place to browse available interesting watches from your phone. It's called Pushers. It's also available on the internet at pushers.io. It's the only place I list my watches for sale. Usually I'll debut the watches with an unboxing on TikTok or something. They'll end up on the Pushers app. I built it with my business partner, Mike Bernstein, who's a programmer and a watch nerd. And I mean, yeah, that's the plug, really. Every day we have new dealers joining. It's like an experiment. Phil was instrumental in kind of pushing me, no pun intended, to get this thing done and really like take it seriously. So it's just a very, very simple, fairly, you know, bare bones, what you see is what you get app to browse watches for sale from just legitimate vetted dealers, not filled with aftermarket crap you might see on other marketplaces, like watches I would vouch for, basically. And that's the app. It's called Pushers. It's in the App Store, and hopefully there'll be an Android version soon. Thank you for letting me do the shameless plug.
Yeah, completely shameless. I didn't know that's the direction you were going to go, but very cool. Cool to see you kind of developing your business from there. Phil, go ahead.
I don't really have anything to plug other than, you know, just cranking away on the next version of what the B would be. And always hunting for more weird watches.
What's the last watch you bought, Phil? Is it this square paddock that you're wearing?
The last one is the Zero Bro.
Oh, right. Of course.
It's going to be hard to get any better than that.
Yeah, of course. You got to take a break after that one, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, a break for him is 2 days.
Yeah, right. Of course.
1 to 2 business days.
Well, guys, I think we're going to leave it there for today's discussion. I appreciate both Mike Nouveau and Phil Toledano joining Hodinkee Radio today. Thanks, as always, to our editor, Vic Ottomanelli, for help with the edit. And of course, thank you all for listening, and we'll see you all again next week for another episode of Hodinkee Radio.